This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
We are as delighted as I think all of you are and as honored to host Isabel Allende here at Politics and Prose this evening. As I said, we realized this week that this event was very much in demand, and I think it's pretty obvious why. Isabel has written 22 books. They've been translated into 35 languages. She's sold 65 million copies worldwide. And many of you may not realize that her repertoire goes beyond books. She also has done plays and opera and movies. And, of course, we admire her so much for her advocacy for human rights and social justice and her founding of the Isabel Allende Foundation in 1992, which is to empower women and girls worldwide. She has won numerous, and I mean numerous awards, more than I could possibly recite here tonight. I did want to mention, in case you aren't aware, that President Obama last year awarded her our nation's highest civilian honor, the Medal of Freedom. And this is another thing that is kind of hard to fathom, but she didn't even write her first novel until she was 40. So, you know, there's hope for many, many people. But from very, very early on, you know, her book, House of Spirits, which was published in 1982 and born out of events in Chile during the Pinochet years, she has compelled, provoked, and delighted readers with her astute observations about the human condition and by her ability to connect individual human emotions and experiences to historical and moral forces in the broader world. Her new book, which she'll be discussing this evening, and I hope you all have gotten copies, and if not, I think we still have some up at the front, is called The Japanese Lover. Like some of her other stories, it's set in the San Francisco Bay Area, where Isabel moved in the late 1980s after fleeing the repressive regime in Chile and spending a dozen or so years in exile in Venezuela. Fans of her earlier works will surely love this new novel as well. But in case you don't trust me, you can trust Ron Charles, who is the book editor of The Washington Post. He wrote in a recent review, "The most appealing aspect of The Japanese Lover is that despite its fearless engagement with horrors on both a national and personal scale, it remains a story of genuine and refreshing generosity. Allende manages to blend domestic comedy, historical fiction, mystery, romance, and even a note of fantasy to create a novel that's a pleasure to recommend." Isabel will be in conversation tonight with Maria Rana, and although we claim Maria's local, which she is, her reputation spans far beyond Washington. Maria served as a judge for the Pulitzer Prize and other literary awards. She is herself a prize-winning author. We were delighted to host her in 2013 for her most recent work, Bolivar, a wonderful biography of Simón Bolívar. We have copies of that, too. Maria has also served, if you're a Post reader, you may know she's also served as editor-in-chief of Bookworld, which was the book review section at the Washington Post. She continues to write about books and all things literary for the Post. She's an advisor to the Librarian of Congress and director of the National Book Festival. We are so delighted to have both of these wonderful and extraordinary women with us this evening. Please join me in welcoming Isabel Allende and Maria Arana.
Much. Can you hear in the back? Yes.
Everybody can hear.
Oh my God, this is crowded. What about the fire? What about the fire department?
Hello, everybody. It's so wonderful to see you all here, and of course, we all know why you're here. This is a splendid, splendid opportunity. We don't get it often enough. I want to thank, first of all, this wonderful store, Politics and Prose. We all know that it is a fantastic monument to literature in this city. So thank you to Politics and Prose, to Brad and to Lissa. Mostly, I want to thank Isabel. I want to say a few words about you. Is that all right?
Not many. Just
a few words.
Let's get to the book.
Some stuff. First of all, for giving us so much of her imagination over the years. I mean, it's not easy to write. It's not easy to build a story. It's like being an engineer, an architect, a construction person, a psychiatrist, a philosopher, a puppeteer. So you're doing a million things, and for more than 30 years, this splendid human being has been giving us one after another marvelous stories, Scheherazade indeed. And as was said, her books have been turned into works in many, many languages, so that she's really known around the world. She was, at one point, Isabel, somebody said to me that you are the best-selling author in Spanish, more than Cervantes, more than Borges, more than who else is left? More than Cortázar, more than anybody. And
well,
those are all
thank
men.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
And those are all men.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah. Thank you to the readers that buy my stuff.
More than your successes, though, what really impresses me, and this is what I really want to thank you for, is your extraordinary humanity. Now, be quiet and let me just say all this
stuff.
Yeah,
but they came here to listen to me, not to you, my dear.
What kind of humanity is that?
So don't talk so much.
That's mean. I was going to say how nice a person you are. Not extraordinary. And I have known her now for 20 years. She's a wonderful friend. And you all must know that because in her books, she comes alive and is a friend to readers in general. So, Isabel, you have been, as was said by Lissa, you started at the age of 40. You were a career person, a mother, an actress for a while, and you started your career largely in exile. How is it? Tell us a little bit about how you feel looking back at that trajectory.
Well, I feel that my life has been like a miracle because I never planned to be a writer. Mm-hmm. I was born in the most socially conservative country in the world, in a Catholic patriarchal family, in the 40s. I look good for my age, don't I? Yeah. Well, from a distance and with a lot of makeup. So I didn't have a chance, and I thought that writers were all male because it was the time of the boom of Latin American literature, and they were all men. There were no space for women. The only models that I had of women writers were some British spinsters that had committed suicide. So, yeah, that was it. So I really became a writer just by chance. I started in Venezuela in 1981, a letter from my grandfather that evolved into my first novel. But I didn't know what I was doing. I had no plan at all.
It was a letter.
It was a letter at the beginning, and then it turned into this book. So I look back, and I don't know what happened. I really don't know what happened.
Every single time you have sat down to write a book, you've written about something different. Let me go through it. Big family saga, tight series of concentrated short stories. You'll know which books I'm talking about. Novel about a man, novel about a woman, tragic memoir, happy memoir, novel about a conquistadora, another about a Haitian slave. How do you decide what you're going to write about next? Where do these ideas come from?
Oof, I think that I have like little seeds in my belly, and each seed is a story. Now, why some of those seeds start to grow and germinate and become so suffocating that I have to write them? I don't know which ones, but all of them are connected to something that is important to me, something that I care for. It could be a personal experience. It could be an obsession. Why would I write a book like Island Beneath the Sea that is the story of the slave revolt in Haiti 200 years ago? Chile had no plantations. We didn't have African slaves. Why would I write about that? And then when I finished the book, I realized that that book is really about absolute power with impunity, something that has obsessed me since the military coup in Chile, when I saw what people can do to other people when they have absolute power and impunity.
So these are things that you've observed that come from inside that sort of fester or nestle there and grow. Do you get ideas and write them down as you go? Does something strike you? Does a newspaper story hit you? I mean, or do these really, are they really seeds from inside?
You know, when I was living in Venezuela, I would just take a look at the press and cut clippings. and all of Eva Luna and the stories of Eva Luna, I got them from the newspapers. But when I left Venezuela and I came to the United States, nothing really interesting happens here. And I mean, what are you going to write about? So I lost that wonderful source of material. But sometimes people say something, or I overhear a conversation in a restaurant and then I take notes on the napkin. Beware, huh? Anything you say can be used against you. I'm always looking for stories. I start all my books on January 8th, and for next January 8th, I don't have anything. So you have a story? Great. You email me the story. Yeah. So I'm looking for stories always, but the stories need to be connected to something that is important to me. Otherwise, I can't write it.
That you care about. Do you think that because you began as a journalist, didn't you? And I remember, because there's this wonderful story about you with Neruda and you going to interview Neruda, and he was not so convinced you should...
Oh, he said I was a lousy journalist. He said I was the worst journalist of my country. He would never be interviewed by me. That I could not be objective, that I lied all the time, and that if I didn't have a story, I would make it up. Why didn't I switch to literature, where all these defects were virtues? And I didn't at the time. It took me a long time, but now I realize that he was right. I was a lousy journalist.
And a really good liar.
Well, yes, I've always been a very good liar. I haven't been caught much, though, which is good.
I want to take you back to the trajectory of your life, Isabel. You married very early, at the age of 20. You had children early. And then you set out on your career. And you, as I mentioned before, you acted, you did a children's program on television, isn't that right?
I did all kinds of crazy stuff.
You did all kinds of crazy things. And basically, the way that it looks to me, you did what you could at the time. And so now, in 2015, a writer's life is not an abnormal trajectory, but it seemed to be at the time when
you were
pursuing.
Well, in Latin America, it certainly was.
Yes.
I mean,
it still is.
Yeah, in Chile at the time, very few women writers had ever been published. Not that women were not writing, they were not published, and if they were published, they were minor editions, they were never reviewed, they were not taught in colleges or universities. I've always said that in this field where I am, and I think that in almost every field, a woman needs to do double the effort of any man to get half the recognition and respect. It has taken me 30 years. Yeah. You know, you get a 19-year-old guy who's writing his memoir and everybody pays attention. I can't believe it.
Okay. Who are the people you admire? Who are your heroes, Isabel?
Well, my heroes are all somehow connected to my foundation. I have a foundation for empowerment of women and children, girls mostly. And I see through the foundation, I mean, thanks to the foundation, I get to meet extraordinary human beings who have overcome the most incredible obstacles, and they survive. They get back on their feet, and they fight, and they become leaders in their communities. People who have an open heart, who have been tortured, who have been raped beyond repair, and yet they can go on with their lives. They can still dance. They can still sing. And those are the models for my books. So people say, you always have strong women in your books. Well, I don't know any weak women. Whom am I going to talk about? And I get to meet all these extraordinary people. So those are my heroes.
Where do you think they get their strength, those extraordinary people?
You know, many people in adversity are broken. And some people are strengthened by the obstacles. Why? We don't know. It must be genetic. There's a beautiful book about a concentration camp survivors. Some survived and most did not. What was the difference? What made those survivors fight to the very end and keep going? We don't know. It's just something, a spirit, I suppose. Some old souls. Love, old souls, I don't know.
Your foundation, before we go into your new book, which I really want to talk about, your foundation, how does it, what does it do? Does it identify the girls and the women? Does it inspire them? What? How does it get them back on their feet?
My daughter-in-law is there in that corner. We travel together. We live together. We work together. And she runs the foundation. And the mission of the foundation is empowerment of women in the areas of education, protection, health care, and, of course, family planning. And we don't invent anything, and we don't work with individuals. We work with programs and organizations that already exist, that are working in the field among the poorest of the poor, and we help finance, but we don't do the work. So the people I admire are the people who are doing the work, you know, that they are extraordinary. And so that's what the foundation does, and if you are interested in knowing more, you Google my name, and the first thing that pops out is the foundation.
So those are your heroes. Who are your enemies?
My enemies?
Men.
No, I like men a lot. You know, you know, right now I don't have a man because I separated from my husband after 27 years of marriage. And so this has been a really bad year. As we say in Spanish, un año de mierda. and a year of losses. My dog died. She was 17 years old and I adored her. Then my agent died. And she's been the godmother of everything that I have.
Carmen Balcells.
Carmen Balcells, everything I've written. My mother broke a hip. Friends have died. And then my marriage ended. So it's not been a good year. But I feel that I'm ready for another man. Yeah. If possible, someone younger. It doesn't have to be Japanese. It can be any nationality. It's fine. Fine.
I don't know if any of you have seen Isabel's TED Talk. Have you seen it? In which she talks about getting older and how that feels and what that means and what is lost and what is gained.
Nothing is gained.
Something about a tortilla and a man, that's all I remember. Yeah.
You know, people think that they will get wiser with age. No, you just become more of what you are. So if you are a jerk, there's no reason why you would become a wise person in your old age. You have to prepare. Of course you have to prepare for that. And I see that most people age badly, especially men. Men my age, if they don't have prostate cancer, they have bad teeth. And it's women take better care of themselves in general.
Well,
but I'm still interested in men. Unfortunately, I'm a heterosexual. I wish I was gender fluid or whatever of those things are. But I'm too old for gender fluidity.
Well, I suppose one way to stay young forever is to write and to write the books that you write. I mean, the Japanese Lover is a wonderful book. I was so pleased to read it because it was, I think, to me, a return. It's so, if you haven't read it, you must buy it, read it. It is crisp. It is agile. It is full of warmth, full of heart. It is terrifying because it addresses so many issues. I mean, you're talking about the Holocaust in Europe. You're talking about the AIDS epidemic. You're talking about the deportation of the Japanese in this country. You're talking about the white slavery and child pornography. you're talking about all of these extraordinary issues all rolled into one. And it doesn't, believe me, it doesn't feel like a lecture. These are human beings all bumping up against each other in life. Amazing.
Thank you very much. Actually, the story was one of those gifts, you know. But, of course, it was connected to me. I was walking in the streets of New York with a friend, and the friend told me that her mother, who's 80, and she's Jewish, had a friend for 40 years that was a Japanese gardener. And so I said, oh, they must have been lovers. And she said, why would you say that of my mother? And I said, well, because if I had had a male friend for 40 years, I would have slept with him, of course. And she said, that's you. And that was it. We didn't talk more about it. But for some reason, that resonated, probably with some seed that I had in my belly. It resonated. Why did it resonate? Because it was a time when I was aging. I mean, after 70, you're supposed to be old. I don't feel old, but I am, according to the calendar, I am. I was losing my marriage. My marriage was ending, so I was exploring love. Can love endure? Why does it end? Can I have romantic love, passionate love at any age? Or is it just something for the young? So all those questions were like in the air for me. And I started writing on January 8th the story of that woman with a Japanese lover, and I couldn't change them. I have no connection to Japan. I've never been there. I don't understand the language, and I have only one friend who is Japanese. Two. Why Japanese lover? Could have been Mexican, would have been easier. But, you know, they come. The characters just come the way they are. I couldn't change him, and I couldn't change the woman either.
So first it was the Japanese man, and only then you decided to do the whole deportation thing because the concentration camps, I should say, because that in itself is an amazing story in this country. We don't know enough about it. People don't talk about it very much. And it's opening it up in a novel like this.
Well, what happens is that in every story that I have written, I have to create the theater where the characters move. And that is the time and the space when they live. In this case, these people were all from San Francisco, and they were 80 years old. What happened in those 80 years? So I started looking at the history of the area, and I realized that after Japan bombed Pearl Harbor, there was a wave of panic in the United States, like after 9/11, and people thought that Japan was going to invade through the Pacific, and they arrested all the people from Japanese origin in the West Coast, 120,000 people. Some of them were immigrants from first generation, they say, and others, most of them, were their children who were American citizens. And they all ended up in concentration camps for 4 years and a half. This is a story that is not very well known, partly because those Japanese families never talked about it. They felt so dishonored, so ashamed of what had happened, that they never talked about it. And their children, many of whom had been in the camps, didn't talk either. It was the grandchildren who have now began to bring the story to the public conversation.
It was a terrible humiliation. And it wasn't only in this country. They were bringing... Japanese, and I know this because I was born in Peru, and in Peru we have a very large Japanese population, and the family of Fujimori, who was the president of Peru for many years, and now is in jail, was deported because it was an ally of the United States and brought up here and was in these mm-hmm. concentration camps. You're right, it was the humiliation so huge that...
They lost everything they had. And then when finally they were released at the end of the war, they were not allowed to go back to the places where they had come from. Mm-hmm. They were sent to other states. So it was a very long and hard episode in the lives of those families.
Something that really strikes me about this story is because you begin it, and you begin it in the old folks' home, and each character is a mosaic, and you plunge back, and each one has a very deep personal story.
Everybody has a secret in the book, and that's a great trick. When I wrote a crime story, Ripper, I attended a mystery writers conference, and there I learned that the most important thing is suspense. How do you hook your reader and not don't let the reader go? And so in a way, I use that in this book. Everybody has a secret that only at the very end of the book you start to understand the relationships and what's going on with them. Yeah.
It's true. I mean, we can't talk too much about the book because we'll give it all away. But there's a splendid character in it, a character that, you know, I love so much, and it's Seth.
Oh, you like Seth. Why do you like him?
He's so perfect. He's like the perfect man.
I would say that Nathaniel is the perfect man.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Seth is just a guy. I mean, I don't think there's anything special about him.
Well, okay, we could talk, and you would be mystified if you haven't read the book. But it's a marvelous set of characters. It really is. And this is a question that annoys a lot of novelists. But I'm going to ask it anyway. To what extent do any of these people live? I mean, do they come from life? Have you used snippets of the past? You certainly did in House of the Spirits.
Well, in the House of the Spirits, that's my family. With a family like that, I don't need to invent anything. They provide everything. But I have a lot of real people in my books. And in this book, of course, it's not exactly the same life, but Alma... there is a character like Alma. There is a character like the doctor in the retirement home that is in a wheelchair. That's my friend Grace Damon, that had a horrible accident in the Golden Gate Bridge, and she's the character for that. Now the retirement home that many people say, oh, that's an idealized retirement home. It couldn't possibly be like that. Actually, it exists. It's called the Redwoods, and it's in Mill Valley, and I researched it thoroughly, and I was able to get in and talk to the staff and talk to people who live there, thanks to Grace, to my friend. So I don't need really to invent that much. I just pick up things from here and there and elaborate on it.
Another thing that you bring to life, to light, that is really, really interesting, at least to me, is the whole business of interracial marriage. And there was a time, I think, you know, we forget that it was only in 1967 that they passed the Loving versus U.S., U.S. versus Loving Act, or whatever it was, the Loving Act. And finally, you know, it was lawful to intermarry. But this is exactly the situation that Alma finds herself in. She loves this man. She's loved him since childhood.
Well. Of course, there was the legal problem that you could not marry someone from another race. But in the case of this couple, she's a wealthy woman who lives in a mansion in San Francisco. And he's the son of the gardener in that mansion. They are separated not only by race, but by social class, by wealth, by culture. And the choice for her, if she had married him, would have been to live in a shack in the Japanese community. She would not do that. And I think she was very smart, because if she had done it, that love would have not survived. The fact that they were secret lovers made the love endure. I totally recommend lovers. I mean, for I think that for enduring love, marriage doesn't work. Much better to see someone in secret and you get together to share the best of yourself and the other person. Yeah, you don't have to do the laundry or sleep with a person who snores and all that.
I'll take the recommendation seriously. I want to ask you now, because we really can't give away more about this book. You just really need to read it. But I want to ask you about what it's like for you, someone who began her career in Latin America, who began her life in Latin America, who created a persona there and then came here, and there is something different, is there not, about being here and about being Latina and about being a writer and about having this particular persona that you have, Isabel?
I don't understand the question.
How does it feel to be, let me make it a more pointed question. Being Latin American in this country, being a Latin American writer.
Yeah, I am a very privileged Latin American, however, because I came here legally. I married a gringo, and I always had documents. So, and I also could support myself with my writing, so I didn't have to be cleaning houses. I could bring my son, and my grandchildren were born here, so I have a family here now. But what I keep saying to other Latinos that are coming to this country or that have already come and they don't feel comfortable is, we don't have to give up who we are. We don't have to give up our language, our culture, the things we bring with us, our sense of honor, of family, our food, our music. We just keep adding. Take everything that this country offers and add it to the bag. We don't have, why would we have to choose if we can have everything? And I think that that's really important.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Before we continue, I just want to honor a person that is here. And this is the most loyal and oldest donor of my foundation. This woman sends every month part of her salary, and it's not a big salary, to the foundation. And we have created a scholarship in her name. Arais, please stand up. Because of Arais, Lori and I feel that we do a good job because she trusts us. So thank you.
It's wonderful.
Thank you.
Congratulations for the wonderful work. I think, in my view, coming from Peru as I did, at least in my parents' generation, the men were educated, the women were not. The women were expected to educate themselves, and they did, and they do. And some of the smartest people in my life that I've known are my aunts, who educated themselves and taught themselves different languages. Education and women.
Well, that is one of the part of the mission of my foundation, because it all starts there. I mean, how can you do anything for someone if you don't give them education first? And we've seen firsthand what education does. Education is not only literacy, it's skills. Sometimes just give a person a skill that will allow that person to come out of poverty, of extreme poverty. And if you educate a woman, you bring the family out of poverty. If you educate families, then you bring a community out of poverty. And then a nation. The most backward and poorest nations in the world is where women are not allowed to have an education.
Absolutely. That's the best message, I think. And thank you to your foundation for giving that message. That's wonderful. I think we should open it up to questions. What do you think?
Yes.
Yeah, no speeches, just no speeches. Questions.
Short, brief questions.
Okay.
Let's start here.
We will repeat the question for the back. Yeah, she asks, how is my day? If I'm writing, and most of the time I am writing, not this year because it's been a terrible year, but in general, when I'm writing, I get up very early, have coffee, walk the dog. I usually meditate a little bit, but so little that it doesn't matter. and then I take the dog out, and I go to my computer and start writing. I spend hours and hours sitting down in my computer. So my son installed some kind of thing in my computer that every 45 minutes I get an alarm to get up and walk a little bit and eat an apple or something, and then I go back to work because I love it. There's no stress in that. When I had a husband, he would call me around 7 for dinner. We would have a glass of wine and dinner. Now I'm waiting for the lover to show up. So I don't know how next year is going to be.
A follow-up question to that, Isabel. Have you always written on a machine?
Yeah, I was a journalist first, on a typewriter, on a little typewriter. And then I had an electric typewriter. And then finally I had a computer. And now only in the computer. I don't take any notes. I don't have a script. I go directly to the story and work and work until it sort of shapes up, but there is no script. Yes.
In regard to your foundation, do you concentrate in one particular area of the world, or is it worldwide?
Yeah, if I concentrate the work of the foundation in one particular area or worldwide, we wish it was just one area, because then we could have better control over it. But once you support a program, you cannot let it go. So we have programs in many places, in Nepal, in India, in Chile, in Mexico, and many among immigrants in the United States. So I would say that it's pretty international. We have more than 100 programs that we support. Yes, in the back. Yeah.
White sweater.
Yeah, she's from Venezuela. She's asking if I have a message for the young people who are now suffering the situation, the political situation in your country. It's hard to have a message. I can only tell you my experience. Governments pass. People stay. We lived in Chile 17 years of a dictatorship that seemed eternal. And that was almost the lifetime of many people, my generation. People of my generation who got out and their children grew up in another country and they were never able to go back. But the country remained and the country survives. And I would say that in spite of the horrible crisis that Venezuela is suffering now, the people in Venezuela are the same and the country is the same. It's a country of abundance. It's a country of generosity. A wonderful place, and it will be that place again. Okay, here.
I was wondering, you talked about the secrets in your book, and I feel like sometimes one of the obstacles in writing is that you don't want to disclose some things that you don't want to disclose.
if I keep any secrets or if they are all in my books. When I wrote Paula, my mother said, you have told everything about you. You've put yourself in such a vulnerable place. But the truth is that what makes you vulnerable are not the truths that you share, but the secrets that you keep. And I have very few secrets, and the only ones I have are the ones that don't belong to me, that I wish I could tell them, but I can't. Okay, the person with the red sweater there. Ah, you had... Yeah, just a minute.
I'm so excited. I've been reading you since I was 16 in Bolivia, and I moved when I was 18, and my grandfather was a writer. I want to know if you knew him or his cousin, who was also a writer, Augusto and Humberto Guzman. And also, who are your favorite authors? You inspired me, so I want to know who inspired you.
Yeah, unfortunately, I didn't know your grandfather. And my favorite writer is me.
Can I point out something? We do have two microphones here, so if you can wend your way up
here. It's very difficult, but let's have the lady there.
If you're close to it.
Yeah, if I'm Peruvian, and why do I write on January 8th? I was born in Peru because my parents were diplomats in Peru, but the children of diplomats, if they are registered in the consulate, have the nationality of the parents. So I have Chilean nationality. And I lived in Peru only until I was three. And why January 8th? Because I started my first book on January 8th, and it was a lucky book. So out of superstition, I start all my books on January 8th. Yes.
Viva Peru. And thank you for being here. My question is more on your writing. So when you start a story, where do you exactly begin? Do you begin in the middle, in the end? Do you begin with one story? And then how do you know when to finish it? How do you know it's like, have I told all the stories that I want to tell in this book?
Well, the first sentence of a book usually is like opening a door into a dark space where the story is. You don't know the story. You don't know the characters. You have to find the tone and the rhythm. And that takes a while, sometimes weeks. But I try to write the first sentence from the belly. I don't think about it. I just sit down and say whatever it is. And that gets me going. Usually that sentence will be somewhere in the book, but not the first sentence, except in few cases, like in Paula and a few other books. And how to finish a book? I don't finish the book. I just give up. Yeah, because you can always add and subtract and correct and edit and whatever. So there is a point when I'm fed up. And I say, okay, done. And so I go to finish the book, and sometimes I have an idea of how to finish it. And then I realized that the book was finished the day before. And anything that I add will take away from the story. So I don't know how it ends. It's just
this book
happens.
Ends beautifully. This book ends beautifully.
Don't say the ending. Yes.
I would like to know, Isabel, I see you as a powerful woman.
What empowers me? Love. The love of my family, my son, my daughter-in-law, of course, the love of my mother, who is 95 and has loved me unconditionally since before I was born, the love of a lot of men, not a lot, less than I would have liked, but some, and of course, animals. I have always had a dog. That is like my soul. So I'm very sad that my dog died. Okay, one question here, and then we will go to the lady in red in the back.
Your work is very political, so of course I have to ask you a political question. How do you feel about
Trump.
Well, not necessarily about Trump, but you have seen what you said people with too much power can do. How do you feel about comments that are very anti-immigrant right now by so many people that want to be leaders of this country? What is your general sentiment about that?
Yeah, that's a way of saying
it
without
saying
naming
names,
it.
But
yeah. Well, I'm disgusted. And absolutely disgusted. People forget that all of you here, except if there is a Native American, come from another place. Yeah. We are all immigrants. And this country was made by immigrants. Who are the immigrants? Usually young people. The old stay behind. People who come here to work, to have children, to contribute, to form a nation. And that is who we are. And so every time there is a new wave of immigrants, we don't welcome them. We didn't want the Jews, we didn't want the Arabs, we didn't want the Italians, we didn't want the Scandinavians, let alone those who look different, like the Chinese or the Hispanics. But everybody contributes. And this is the strength. Diversity is the strength of this country. Absolutely. Thank you. Yeah, the lady in the back. In the back over there. You.
Okay. Well, yeah, I'm going to say you can pass.
I just wanted to make a quick suggestion that you ask George McKay if he has a straight young brother. But my question is, what do you think it would take to resurrect Cody's bookstore in Berkeley?
Oh, that's a strange question, because I don't know. What would it take to resurrect Cody's bookstore in Berkeley? A wonderful, wonderful bookstore that was there for many years. But you know, the problem is that some businesses just don't survive. And it's been very hard for most independent bookstores all over the country. There are many cities in the United States that do not have a bookstore. Many. Wait, over here. Yes.
Thank you.
Hi. I was wondering if you had advice for young writers, specifically young female writers who are asking you a question right now.
Well, I would say the same thing to female writers, transgender, males, whatever. It's the same answer. And it's not my answer. It's from Elizabeth Gilbert, that I heard her say that somebody asked the same question. And she said, don't expect your writing to give you fame or money. You write because you love the process, and every word that you don't write will weigh like a stone. And I think that is so smart, because we are always thinking that what we write will be published. No. Most of us will write without being published, but we love the process. And writing is such a wonderful way of exploring our own souls and our own, and creating our own legend also.
Thank you.
Which one? Yeah, I don't know which one.
Hi.
The microphone, I'm sorry.
That's all right. Hi. I would like to know what are your thoughts in the relationship between spirituality and religion. Do you think somebody not being religious can be spiritual?
If someone that is not religious can be spiritual, of course. Of course. I think that sometimes you can be very religious and not be spiritual at all.
Thank you.
And the other way around. I know many people who are very spiritual and have no official religion. You know, some time ago, I was invited to give the keynote speech in a conference in Vienna, in the Melk Abbey, a conference of religious leaders. Why on earth they invited me? It was because someone made a mistake. And they flew me in a helicopter to this beautiful abbey to talk to the religious leaders of the world. And I get there, there were no women. They were all men. There were Catholic priests, Orthodox priests, Jewish rabbis, a lot of Tibetan people in robes, all men. 51% of humanity is women. Why do they identify with these religions that are totally patriarchal? I've never understood that. So many of my women friends who are really spiritual just don't belong to any religion because they don't feel represented.
Thank you.
Yes.
Does your foundation in the San Francisco area have alliance with criminal justice and the therapeutic effect of writing, making amends? I was struck by the discomfort about those seeds. You had to get them out.
Yeah.
And if they fester, if they don't get out, San Quentin, or you're in Vacaville, or you're in San Francisco's jail. What can we do?
He's talking about how writing can help people who are in prison, and if my foundation works in programs like that. There are several programs, but my foundation doesn't work with them. We work mostly with women. And we are not working with the, but we should actually, because it's a wonderful thing that is, that can be very healing. Writing and telling your story is always very healing. We have so many hands here. So yeah, you. You are so hidden over there. How can we see you?
What is the perfect man?
What is the perfect... Love that question. A ver, let's see. You ladies, say, what is the perfect man?
A gentleman.
What is a gentleman?
A
huh? A sense of humor. Good lover. What else? Honest.
Respectful.
What? Respectful. Can cook. Huh? Great father. A friend.
A reader.
Huh? Compassionate. Does he have to be handsome? Yes or no? Who says yes? You know, women are willing to compromise. You don't have to be handsome, but you are actually very handsome. Yeah. Okay, you little one.
Do you recommend any of your books for kids?
I have three books for kids. Three books for kids called City of the Beast, Kingdom of the Golden Dragon, and I forgot the last one, Forest of Something. And then I have another one called Sorrow that you can read. How old are you?
8.
Yeah, you can read all of those. Yeah, but I'm not going to write any more books for kids because I don't like kids. Yes. Ask a question. Just a minute.
Working with women in real comfortable situations, especially in societies that are very machista, or where it may be dangerous to for women to be becoming more empowered, or for women to see.
Well, she's talking about how to help women who have gone through horrible situations, especially in very male chauvinistic society. That's exactly what my foundation does. Google my name. Well, that would take a lecture. Go to the website. Yes.
Many people come here to buy a Spanish book, and we are 50 million people, Spanish people in this country. And let me tell you, it's very hard to find good book like yours in Spanish. How many people here are waiting for a Spanish book and they don't have it? Mm-hmm. You see what I mean?
Yeah, well, it's too bad because I'm sure that if you order it in this bookstore, you will get it. But it's true. It's hard to get books in Spanish. It's hard for me, too. I have to order them from Spain. There's people on the microphones. Come on.
Okay, I don't have a question, but I just want to thank you. And I never dreamt of having the opportunity of telling directly to you. Thank you because you helped me in the most difficult time of my life when I lost my grandfather. Because I read Paula, I understood this process. And I was able to tell him, goodbye, Grandpa Man. Hello, Grandpa Spirit. And it was all because of you. So I really want to thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. That's lovely. Thanks. Yeah, over here, the microphone.
Well, thank you so much. Your book was amazing, and you're a true inspiration to me. So I was wondering, what's your perspective on overcoming fears and difficult situations in life, and also letting things go? And especially, like, if there is any advice for women, like, that you can share with us.
Well, letting go, that's an art that you learn in life because things are taken away from you all the time. When I lost my daughter, when Paula died, my mother said, I was devastated, absolutely devastated, and I thought I would never survive the experience. And my mother said, This kind of sorrow is like a long and dark tunnel that you have to walk alone, step by step, day after day, tear after tear. And you have to walk with the certainty that there is light at the other end. Just keep walking. And since then, I have had a few other tunnels in my life, none as dark and long as that one. But every time that I find myself in a situation like that, like this year that has been such a bad year for me, I know it's a tunnel that I will be able to walk day by day, and one day I will be out. And I know that by next year, I will be on the other side of the tunnel, and there will be light. So what I would say to people who are in any kind of crisis, keep walking and try not to walk alone. We are surrounded by people who with whom you can share whatever is happening to you. Just be open and share. That helps a lot.
Thank you.
Miss Allende, it's truly a privilege to be able to meet you. I am an immigrant from Venezuela, and I've been in the United States for 10 years now. And it is thanks to your books that I was able, because I immigrated when I was 14, it is thanks to your books that I was able to rekindle my passion for my country, for my region, for our language, and for our history. And I really wanted to thank you for that. And I also had a small request. It's been 10 years since I've seen my mother for various reasons. We have not been able to reconnect. And today is her birthday. And if it's not too much of an imposition, may I please request if you could wish her happy birthday in Spanish?
¿Cómo se llama tu mamá?
Estela Pérez.
Bueno, para Estela Pérez, un feliz cumpleaños de todos nosotros. De todos.
Thank you.
This is a very personal question. So
yeah, we can give you a very personal answer.
¿Dónde se encuentra la fuerza para escribir un libro como Paula?
Where do you find the strength to write a book like Paula? Actually, the book helped me a lot. Without the writing, I think I would have died. Writing helped me to, I have to go back a little. The whole year of Paula's illness was a year of waiting, praying, hoping. And every day was exactly the same as the day before. Nothing changed. And I had the feeling that all that year had been just one long night. Writing the book, and in order to write the book, I read 180 letters that I had written to my mother that year. And I could see that not all the days were alike, that things happened. I could organize things. And also, I could somehow contain the event, that it had invaded all my life. All my life was dark. And then by writing the book, I was able to set limits to what had happened, choose adjectives to describe it. And in narrating it, I could give order, some kind of order. I could understand it better and accept it. And I could look around and see that, yes, Paula had died, but my grandchildren were being born. There was new life. There was my son, my people around me. Not everything was death. There was a lot of life, and it helped me a lot. So I don't think I needed strength to write it. On the contrary, the book gave me strength.
Gracias.
Here with a colored sweater.
What means to me September 11th, 1973? That's the day of the military coup in Chile. You know, in my life, there have been certain events that have changed the direction of my life. And they have all been out of my control. Things that have happened, and I just could not control the circumstances. I think the first was the fact that my father abandoned my mother when I was three. And that changed the course of my mother's life and my life as well. Then, of course, the military coup in Chile. I think that my life was going in a certain direction, and like the lives of millions of Chileans, I'm no exception. And the military coup changed everything and forced me out of my country. And I became a political refugee in Venezuela. So, and then, of course, the death of my daughter and a few other things that have happened that have sort of guided me in different directions. The military coup changed me also as a person. I think that I was an eternal adolescent, a teenager, until that day when I realized that there was a dimension of evil and violence in every society that, given the wrong circumstances, it emerges. So we have to be very careful. We live in a civilized world because we have agreed on certain rules. And as long as we stick to those rules, we can sort of control the savage thing that each one of us has inside. And when that is out of control, anything can happen.
We have time for two more questions. Is there someone way in the back that we haven't? There's a hand way in the back. You. Can you come forward a little bit?
What is it?
What connection do I feel to Chile? Well, my roots are in Chile. My parents are in Chile. I am Chilean. And, of course, I'm Chilean-American, but I write in Spanish. I think in Spanish, and I feel that I do a lot of research for stories that I place in other parts of the world. But if it's placed in Chile, I don't need to research. I have it inside. It's in my DNA. And I am connected to Chile daily thanks to my mother's letters. She writes to me every single day. Yes.
I'm Chilean.
Chilena, yeah. Puedes preguntar en español y lo traducimos.
Sí, dos cosas. La primera era un poco relacionada con esa pregunta. ¿Cómo te mantienes todavía conectada con el Chile de hoy, ya que es tan distinto a cómo lo dejaste tú?
Sí. Yeah, well, the first question I already answered is about the connection to Chile. And the other one is that we have a very special way of talking. We talk terribly. And our accent is absolutely terrible. And if I still keep it, no, thank God, I got rid of most of it. And let me tell you why. Because when I... Yeah, of course. In every country has its own accent and slang. If we use it in literature, people don't understand a word. How can my translators in Albania translate Chilean slang? That would be impossible. By the way, let me say just a little anecdote about translation. People ask me all the time about the translation of my books because they've been translated to so many languages. Of course, I can only read the English translation, and I have no idea what happens with the other 34 languages. I just came back from Europe, and I was in the Netherlands, and I was interviewed by a journalist. And the journalist said, before we get started, let me tell you, I'm fascinated with your sense of humor and your irony. In your book, Ripper, you have this incredible arthritic rabbit. And I don't remember my books very well, and I never read them. And I don't have such good memory, but I'm absolutely sure that I haven't mentioned a rabbit unless it's cooked. So I said, let alone with arthritis. So I said, I don't know if I have an arthritic rabbit in. Well, then, after much research, I discovered that it was a little problem in the translation. That I had a poodle. And the poodle was translated into a rabbit for some strange... And it improved the book a lot. So if you have any possibility of reading my books in Dutch, please do.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, everybody.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.